Will not go in vain.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with us here on the Spotlight. Yves Engler, author and political activist out of Montreal. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press out of Tehran. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillah. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ هَاجَرُوا وَجَاهَدُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْخَمْرِ وَالْمَيْسِرِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. Hamas says Israel's repeated attacks on Gazans waiting for aid prove that the regime seeks to deepen the humanitarian crisis in besieged territory. The United Nations Children's Fund warns that many more children in Gaza will die of dehydration and malnutrition unless obstacles to provide aid are removed. Also coming up, Iraq's Islamic Resistance says it has launched a drone attack on a chemical facility in the Israeli port of Haifa in support of Gaza. Thanks for joining us. Palestinian resistance movements have denounced Israel for carrying out yet another deadly attack on a crowd of Palestinians waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. Hamas says the attack proves that Israel is pushing ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza. Added that Israel wants to deepen the humanitarian crisis in the besieged territory with its systematic use of starvation against Palestinians. In a separate statement, the Islamic Jihad says the attack is another proof of the regime's criminal nature. It called on the Arab and Muslim countries to take actions to stop Israel's massacre of Palestinians. Israeli forces on Sunday shelled hundreds of Palestinian aid seekers who had gathered near the Kuwaiti roundabout in Gaza. The shelling killed 9 Palestinians and injured dozens more. Over 100 Palestinians were killed on Thursday after Israeli troops opened fire at people waiting for food aid in Gaza City. The UN Children's Fund, meanwhile, has warned that many more children in Gaza will die of dehydration and malnutrition unless there is direct intervention to provide assistance. UNICEF's regional director, Adel Khodr, added these tragic deaths are man-made, predictable, and entirely preventable. She said that a lack of nutritious food, clean water, and medical services is a direct consequence of preventing aid supplies to Gaza. She demanded that aid agencies be allowed to bring in relief assistance through all possible crossings. Meanwhile, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food called for sanctions against Israel, saying this is the only way to reach a ceasefire in Gaza. Michael Fakhri added a famine is looming in Gaza, as Tel Aviv is intentionally starving Palestinians there. Earlier we spoke to our correspondent Mutaba Musaba in Deir al-Balah in Gaza. He told us that Israel hasn't stopped its attacks on humanitarian aid trucks in the besieged strip.
Over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes renewed their attacks against the northern part of Gaza Strip. Several residential buildings were destroyed, particularly in the eastern part of Jabalia refugee camp and Beit Lahia town in the far north of Gaza Strip. As a result of these continuous attacks and airstrikes hitting several areas of Gaza Strip, 31 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed as a result of the Israeli airstrikes in Rafah over the last night. We are in front of continuous Israeli airstrikes, and according to the UN, that the Palestinian children here in Gaza are dying slowly before the eyes of the whole world. This reflects how catastrophic the humanitarian conditions are, because the people here, particularly the Palestinian children, are living catastrophic humanitarian conditions. They are completely deprived of their basic humanitarian supplies, particularly milk, food, and drinkable water, leaving them suffering amid an unprecedented situation. They are suffering from the dehydration and the malnutrition, which threatens the lives of thousands of the Palestinian children here in Gaza Strip. In the meantime, the European Mediterranean Center for Human Rights actually announced that they have documented dozens of the cases of the Israeli tanks running over the Palestinian dead bodies, particularly in the western part of Khan Yunis city. They have documented dozens of the Palestinian civilians squashed under the chains of the Israeli tanks while they were attacking those residential areas, while they were attacking the tents taken shelter by the Palestinian evacuees in Khan Yunis and elsewhere in Gaza Strip.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has attacked the Israeli port of Haifa, the occupied territories, in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. The Iraqi resistance says it targeted a chemical facility in the port with a drone. It added that the operation was carried out in response to Israel's massacre of Palestinian civilians, including women and children, in Gaza. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a number of attacks on Israeli targets in recent months. The group has also struck major American military bases in Syria and in Iraq, amid anger over the U.S. support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. The European NGO says that Israeli tanks have deliberately run over dozens of Palestinians in separate incidents across Gaza. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that a young Palestinian man lost his life after the regime forces ran over him in Al Zaytun district in Gaza City on Thursday. The Geneva-based NGO cited similar other incidents that have taken place in different areas of the besieged territory in recent weeks. It also confirmed that Israeli forces destroyed civilian property, especially vehicles, during their ground assault on various areas of Gaza. Euromed noted that the regime troops have caused such destruction with no necessity or justification. The U.S. redesignation of the Hezbollah movement as a terrorist group has had little effect other than worsening the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is already in a critical condition. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
A series of restrictions were imposed on the Yemeni economy following the U.S. redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group earlier this year. This blacklisting has had an impact on the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country, where millions of people are in dire need of aid.
Ansarullah as a political component has no external economic relations or companies in the private sector that have real weight in the national economy. The real goal of the resolution is to blackmail Ansarullah and distort their position in support of Gaza. The Yemeni economy has been in a state of siege for 9 years, and therefore the American measures putting pressure on the local economy we believe will not have much effect, especially since the Yemeni economy has withstood pressure over the past years and adapted to the measures imposed by the exiled Yemeni government in Riyadh. The Central Bank of Yemen will also work to impose procedures to secure the transfer of foreign exchange to and from Yemen.
Several international companies, including the money transfer company Western Union, have suspended their activities in Yemen, severely affecting the livelihoods of most Yemenis who rely on financial support from relatives abroad. Experts predict that such actions will lead to the creation of a black market for those benefiting from the suspension of money transfers.
The United States of America imposed collective punishment on the Yemeni people. Very important financial channels were stopped, such as Western Union, which is one of the most important money transfer networks in the world, and through it, Yemeni expatriates in American and European countries used to send money to their families in Yemen easily. We have 6 million expatriates outside the country and thousands of Yemeni families depend on them to provide a living. You can imagine what the situation will become after these financial transfers stop. The beneficiaries of this measure are black market workers who exploit these circumstances by deducing a percentage of their remittances and transfer them through illegal channels.
In an effort to deter Yemen's naval operations against vessels linked to the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, the U.S. Department of State blacklisted the Ansarullah movement as a specially designated global terrorist group. However, this designation has primarily affected the humanitarian situation, as members of the Ansarullah movement have no investments abroad.
Observers believe that Washington's recent measures are aimed at inciting the Yemeni people to take to the streets in opposition to the Ansarullah movement as a strategic move to undermine the group's popularity in the country. But that plot does not look like it will succeed, given the widespread support for Ansarullah in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Pakistan's parliament has re-elected Shahbaz Sharif as the country's prime minister amid nationwide protest demonstrations by supporters of the jailed former premier Imran Khan over allegations of vote rigging. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi brings us more from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad.
It was the second occasion on which Pakistani lawmakers elected Shahbaz Sharif as the new premier of the country. Shahbaz Sharif assumed office as Pakistan's prime minister for the first time in April 2022, following the dramatic ouster of Pakistan's jailed ex-prime minister Imran Khan from power through a parliamentary no-confidence vote. Sharif, the younger brother of Pakistan's three-time prime minister Nawaz Sharif, secured 201 votes in the lower house of the parliament. He emerged victorious over his rival Omar Ayub Khan of the PTI party led by jailed ex-PM Khan, who managed to secure 92 votes. A candidate needs a simple majority of votes in the 336-member house to win the post.
From the deepest core of my heart, I thank those who with their votes and love elected me as the leader of this house. People have been given a split mandate in the general elections, and those having reservations about election results need to approach the appropriate forums. We have no personal egos, and the other side also needs to follow the suit for the sake of Pakistan.
The election of the new Pakistani premier was marred by nationwide protests by the supporters of imprisoned Imran Khan against alleged rigging in the recently held elections. Several party workers who were staging protest demonstrations against results manipulation in the recently held elections were arrested.
I'm here to request Election Commission of Pakistan, the Judiciary of Pakistan and Chief Secretary of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa to take strict action against the ROs, the DROs, who not only violated the Election Act and election rules and oath of their offices, but also violated Constitution of Pakistan, in which preamble states that the people of Pakistan will decide the fate of their representatives through ballot.
The newly elected premier, Sharif, who is expected to take the oath of the office on Monday, has been congratulated by several neighboring countries, including China, Iran, and Turkey.
As Shahbaz Sharif assumes the role of prime minister for a second time, he is pitted against a multitude of challenges. These include fragile economic and political conditions. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Iran's president has called on the International Court of Justice to stop the Israeli genocide in Gaza by delivering a guilty verdict against the regime as soon as possible. Ibrahim Raisi says the sentence in South Africa's genocide case against the regime will also bring an end to Israeli occupation and lead to the trial of the regime's leaders and its allies. Raisi made the remarks in a press conference with the Algerian president following their meeting in Algiers. He said that Iran and Algeria both support the rights of the Palestinians and oppose Israeli occupation and crimes. The Iranian president said the hands of the U.S. and some other Western countries are stained with the blood of people in Gaza. Raisi, however, expressed confidence that Palestinians would prevail against Israel and its allies. For his part, Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune hailed Iran's position on the issue of Palestine and slammed the silence of some countries on the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Vote counting is underway in Iran for two major elections that were held on Friday. The polls will determine the fate of the next parliament and also the assembly of experts. According to officials, more than 15,000 nominees competed in Friday's elections, and over 40% of those eligible for voting participated in the elections. Our correspondent Gisumi Shahmadi is at the Ministry of Interior to update us on the results.
As far as the vote counting is concerned, the fate of 230 seats of the parliament, the 290 seats, 230 of them are now decided, but for the rest of them, we might have to go to a second round of elections, maybe later in April. We don't know exactly how this is going to play out, and that is why we are waiting for a very important press conference that will take place tomorrow, 8 a.m. local time. The Interior Minister himself will be talking to reporters and taking questions about what is going to happen next. Well, in some of those small constituencies which only have one or two seats in the parliament, the fate of those seats have already been determined. We know that less than a handful of them now will be going to the next round for sure. But right now, at this moment, we have all our eyes on the big provinces and the big constituencies, most importantly Tehran constituency, which will definitely determine the landscape, the political landscape of the Iranian parliament in its 12th term. And this is why everyone is waiting for those final results. Behruz, we do know that some of the heavyweights, such as Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, and who is actually right now the parliament speaker, Mr. Nabavian, are among those that have gained many votes, and they are definitely going into the parliament. There's also the former foreign minister of Iran, Manoucher Mottaki, another well-known politician that will be entering the parliament. But in order to draw a landscape, we're going to have to wait for those final results.
The United States and South Korea have kicked off 10-day annual war games that they insist are defensive in nature. South Korea's defense ministry says the number of troops participating in the exercises is twice as many as last year. They involve air forces from both South Korea and the U.S. South Korean media say the drills could also include American strategic assets. The war games are expected to trigger an angry reaction from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. The country considers drills in the region with the participation of the U.S. as existential threats and rehearsal for invasion. Pyongyang has responded to the provocations by a record number of missile threats in recent months. And that is for this additional world news. Thanks for tuning in. It's bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The head of a Norway-based NGO has been shocked after witnessing the catastrophic humanitarian conditions in Rafah in southern Gaza caused by the Zionist regime's months-long genocidal war on the besieged Palestinian territory. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, visiting a school sheltering some 4,500 displaced Palestinians who fled Gaza City in the north of the territory and nearby Khan Yunis, Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, in a post published on X platform, recently expressed his dismay at the living conditions they were enduring. He said, the disabled, the pregnant, and the newborn share 18 latrines with 4,500 others. Malnutrition, epidemic disease, and trauma is everywhere. Egeland slammed the Zionist regime and its allies for carrying out a relentless onslaught against the besieged civilian population of Gaza and called it a stain on an international community which has failed to secure any kind of restraint or humanitarian access. He called the situation in Gaza in an interview with CNN recently, people are traumatized beyond belief and live under the most horrific condition. In an earlier post from the Rafah border crossing into Gaza, Egeland said hundreds of aid trucks were waiting to travel into the Palestinian territory to help a starving civilian population. He added, the system is broken, he said, of the process involved in allowing aid into Gaza, adding, Israel could fix it for the sake of the innocent. Recently, a United Nations official said that Israeli forces are systematically blocking access to people in need in Gaza, complicating the task of delivering aid to the besieged Palestinian territory. Rafah, the town along the Egyptian border, which was once deemed a safe zone by the Zionist regime military forces, has now become the last refuge for over half of Gaza's entire population of more than 2.3 million who have fled their homes in other parts of the territory to shelter from incessant Israeli regime attacks. At least 500,000 people are facing famine in Gaza, while the entire population of the territory is experiencing acute food shortage, according to figures from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. Over 30,000 Palestinians, including 14,000 children, have been killed in Gaza, 146 days into the latest offensive launched by the child killer regime of Israel, according to Gaza's health ministry. The Electronic Intifada also wrote, Ahmad Hanun and his extended family are now living on a poultry farm in Rafah in southern Gaza. Their rudimentary shelter is not suitable accommodation for humans, but they have nowhere else to go. There are so many others in a similar situation. About 1.3 million people, more than half of all Gaza's inhabitants, are crammed into Rafah following mass displacement. The Hanuns were forced to leave their home in Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of Gaza City. The Zionist regime has repeatedly bombarded the area during the current genocidal war. The farm where they are now living does not have a bathroom. To use one, they visit Al Hilal Al Emirati, a maternity hospital in Rafah. The family have arranged showers among the farm's battery cages. They have boiled water on a wood fire before showering. Ahmad Hanun said, we have to strip off in front of each other. There is no privacy during the war. The farm where they live smells terribly and they constantly have to contend with insects. The children have experienced diarrhea. Loy, a 7-year-old boy, has been diagnosed with hepatitis A. His health is in a very serious condition. When it rains heavily, the area where they live has been flooded by sewage, destroying blankets, mattresses, and even food. The family's only protection during wet weather is to stay inside the cages. Ahmad Hanun said, I find it unbelievable that we live in such filth. This is a place for animals and birds, not people. We had anticipated staying here for a few days until we found somewhere more suitable, but we haven't managed to find anywhere else. Adil Jom'e had to flee his home in Jabalia refugee camp, northern Gaza, a few months ago. First, he and his family went to Khan Yunis in the south. Later, they moved to Rafah. After seeking an apartment in Rafah, they realized that they could not afford the high rents being charged. They ended up assembling a tent on the grounds of a zoo owned by a relative. That means they have to live beside animals who are starving. A number of the lions in the zoo have already died since the war began. With food scarce, the zoo's owner is trying to keep the remaining lions alive with bread. The lions had previously eaten chicken. The zoo animal's weight has fallen drastically. The bathroom in the zoo is located close to the animal's cages. Adele's 7-year-old son, Rami, is terrified of going to the bathroom after dark. The boy started experiencing severe pains recently. When he was brought to hospital, he was diagnosed with kidney stones and required surgery. The doctor told the family that such problems can occur if children try to avoid urinating. Rami has trouble sleeping as he is afraid of the lions. He has asked his parents repeatedly if the animals can escape from the cages and attack humans. Sarah, his mother, replied that animals pose no risk to people who feed and care for them. Sarah said, Rami is always asking when he can leave this horrific place and go back to our old home. I don't know how to answer him. I am lost for words. Yasser Helles and his family are now living in a greenhouse near Rafah's seashore. Given that the Zionist regime's naval forces are firing toward Rafah, the area is anything but safe. The family had to take shelter there as tents in short supply and the few available ones costly, Yasser said. It takes weeks just for a charity to give you one. There are so many people on the list for tents, so we were forced to take shelter here, which is not a suitable place to live. Ahmad Yasser's 15-year-old son recently went to a local school and queued for hours before he could find water. Once his container was filled, he used a wheelchair to transport it. Yet the wheelchair fell over and water spilled. On his way back to his family, Ahmad was distraught. Since they have taken shelter in the greenhouse, the extended family have been sleeping on mattresses. Yasser's 72-year-old mother has experienced backache. Yasser said, I often could not find painkillers for her in pharmacies or in UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees clinics. She cannot bear the agony.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we'll be analysing the prospects for pro-Palestine candidates who'll be standing against mainstream political parties in the upcoming British general election, which must be called within the next 10 months. Latifa Abu Chakra has been looking at some of the constituencies where pro-Palestine candidates have already been selected and has this report.
There will be general elections across England this year, and it seems that pro-Palestinian candidates may just give pro-genocide Labour supporters a tough time in the ballot box. Labour leader Keir Starmer stated early on in the genocidal campaign that he supported the right of the Zionists to withhold food, water, and electricity from Gaza, and his MPs may pay dearly for his fealty to Israel. In Rochdale, firebrand George Galloway is standing in the by-election to take the seat from Labour. In a fascinating twist to the story, his hand has been strengthened by an Israel lobby hit job on his Labour opponent, Azhar Ali. Tony Blair had Ali as an advisor on terrorism. Lancashire County Council called Ali a champion for the Prevent agenda. He and Harris Rafiq of the Quilliam Foundation also founded a group that was funded by Prevent. The Board of Deputies, which collaborates closely with the Israeli embassy, promoted the organization. But none of that was enough for the lobby, which demanded Ali's head on a plate for his private questioning of the October the 7th narrative. Azhar Ali being pushed out of the Labour Party has meant that Galloway does not have a Labour opponent in Rochdale. Another key battleground for pro-Palestinian parliamentary aspirations will be Ilford North, where Palestinian Leanne Mohammed will take on Israel lobby-funded Wes Streeting. Over the past years, Streeting has received funding for office costs from key Israel lobbyists Jonathan Mendelsohn and Trevor Shin. Streeting has also played a key role as an Israel lobby political hitman over the years. The poetic justice of his being removed by a descendant of the displaced Palestinians is just irresistible. Starmer himself is facing a challenge in his own constituency from former ANC MP Andrew Feinstein. Feinstein is the son of Holocaust survivors and served as a member of parliament in Nelson Mandela's government following his release from prison in South Africa. Starmer, who has done everything to support Israeli apartheid and now genocide in Palestine, may just get his comeuppance in the forthcoming elections.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is James Giles, who's George Galloway's election agent in the upcoming Rochdale by-election, and I spoke to him earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, I mean, do you think the Labour Party are going to pay an electoral price at the upcoming general election?
Oh, I certainly hope so, and I believe that's the case as well. I mean, the extraordinary thing about what happened in Rochdale, where their candidate was removed for having a slight difference of opinion or emphasis with the Zionist talking points, is amazing. I mean, if you or I were in the Zionist war rooms and we said, this guy's said something vaguely off colour, should we get rid of him? What would we say? We'd say, no, he's our candidate. Yeah. I mean, who else is going to defeat George? And they've destroyed their own chances there. And, of course, that's going to mean probably a victory for George in Rochdale. And, of course, there's all sorts of pushback going on against the Labour Party. I mean, the debacle in the House of Commons about the vote on the ceasefire, which, of course, is entirely 100% Starmer's fault, is a real indication of how far they're willing to go, to not just to push the Zionist entity's lines, but to actually take briefing from the President of Israel on matters of British parliamentary democracy. I mean, it's a real indication of the way in which Israel runs this country.
Sure. Well, I started by asking James if he felt that Labour had eaten itself effectively in Rochdale with their fake anti-Semitism codswallop.
It's quite unusual, isn't it, to have a campaign where pretty much every other player has left the field. Labour left the field with Azhar Ali, who said some very silly things. The Green Party left the field. Their candidate also said some very, I'm going to call them silly things. The Conservative candidate is on holiday in Egypt and won't be back until polling day. And as for Simon Danchuk, well, he was disgraced long before this by-election. So I think all of the other parties have eaten themselves. Which is part, although not in full, why we are now the bookies' favourite to win in Rochdale. Well, look, if you'll forgive me for speaking candidly, Labour put forward a shortlist of two candidates. Azhar Ali, not a Rochdalian, someone who lives in neighbouring Lancashire, and Paul Waugh, the Eye journalist, who actually is one of my constituents here in Kingston-upon-Thames, where I'm the leader of the opposition. He, of course, was born in Rochdale, but has lived in Kingston for some time. And it was a choice between Azhar or Paul. Look, I wasn't at the Labour meeting, but dare I say, they knew George Galloway was going to stand. I think Azhar Ali was picked in a rush, largely to appeal to, so they thought, the sizeable Muslim population in the constituency. And just look how that has blown up in their faces.
David, I mean, with your victory in the courts and now this in Rochdale, I mean, do you think we're seeing a kind of a vindication of sorts for all those people that have been smeared for all these years?
Well, of course we are. I mean, the last 4 or 5 months with the ongoing, very, very visible day-by-day genocide by the Zionists, that everybody now knows that the stuff that I've been saying, that many others have been saying about Zionism being racism, everyone knows this is true now, and no one has anything really to say about it. The Zionists just respond by coming up with lies, oh, Hamas did this, Hamas did that. And they're even being satirised about it on TikTok by thousands and thousands of young TikTok users. So it's very clearly a vindication for all of us who are anti-Zionists. And but it's not just that. It's also the beginning of the end of Zionism, I think. Zionism as a project looks extremely unsafe now. And it's very, very difficult to see how it can win anything from this. It may stagger on for another few years, but it looks like it's the beginning of the end for the Zionist project as a whole.
Yeah. Well, I then asked James, what sort of George Galloway's day-to-day schedule was like in the run-up to the Rochdale by-election?
Well, look, no 2 days are ever quite the same in Rochdale. George will wake early and finish late, always in the office, no later than 9:30. Meeting voters, meeting business owners, meeting stakeholders, going out and fighting for every last vote, often not finishing until midnight. You must forgive the slightly scruffy state of me at the moment. I also fall into that trap. I haven't had time for a haircut, and most nights I don't finish until 2, maybe 3 a.m. together with a loyal band of volunteers. But that really is the beauty, if you like, of a by-election. But all I can say is, thank God it's only, 4.5 weeks long? Well, look, there's a wide number of issues in Rochdale. The media have been obsessed with Gaza, with Palestine, and, rightly, a good section of the population have that as their primary issue in this by-election. But what the media aren't reporting is that the campaign is speaking out on a whole host of issues. Would you believe you can't be born in Rochdale? There's no maternity unit. You can't die in Rochdale either. There's no A&E. So we're campaigning to reinstate maternity services in Rochdale. Would you believe the town hall has had £20 million spent on it, yet the clock still can't tell the correct time on the town hall? I think that epitomises the state of the local authority in Rochdale, where youth services have been cut to the core, where they can't even find a bucket of tar to fix the seemingly endless number of potholes. I think if I could sum it up in one way, I would say that people are disillusioned with Labour locally, disillusioned with the Tories nationally. They're fed up of the political class, which is why they're looking afresh at George. I'll end my answer to this question, I think, with this. The day before Azhar Ali was suspended as the Labour candidate, the pipes burst in the Labour HQ. True story, I promise. And excrement was spilt from the pipes all over the leaflets of Azhar Ali, an omen, if you like. And I think that is also the epitome of how Labour have run the town. There's excrement everywhere. The services are terrible. I would use the SH word, but I won't end it and I won't say it because it's not broadcastable.
David, just say a word or two, will you, about Wes Streeting and his links to the Zionist lobby. And do you think Leanne Mohammed can actually beat him in Ilford North, where she's been selected, obviously, to build an insurgent campaign similar to what George has been doing in Rochdale?
Well, as we heard in the film there, Streeting has had contributions to his office costs from Trevor Chin, who is a well-known Israel lobbyist and,
of course, has been
attached directly to Starmer's staff. Effectively, he is the most senior officer of the Zionist movement in the UK, has been for some decades. And also, of course, from Lord Mendelssohn, John Mendelssohn, who, of course, was involved in the first Labour lobbying scandal under New Labour back in the late 90s. And of course, he's also involved with charities which are funding the IDF, Jewish supremacist organizations, indeed settlements in occupied Palestine. So we know that kind of link. But look, Wes Streeting was recruited to the Zionist movement many, many years ago when he was still in the National Union of Students. He traveled to the Zionist entity at the expense of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and took part in the Global Forum for Combating Anti-Semitism, the body which constructed the weapon to use against the left, which is fake anti-Semitism, the alleged identity between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So he's effectively been recruted by the Israel lobby for many, many years, and that's his position.
Sure. Well, I also asked James about George Galloway's Workers' Party fielding more candidates in other constituencies.
Well, look, prior to this by-election, the party had already announced it was fielding 50 candidates in seats across the country at the next general election. If we win in Rochdale, and I believe we will win in Rochdale, I'm quite sure the party will explode in a good way, unlike Labour's candidate who imploded. I'm sure the party will see a flurry of new members, a flurry of new branches, and a flurry of new activity. And so who knows where that current 50 seat promise could end up.
Well, I'm just going to pause the discussion there for a moment for our second report. This one's about the role of the Labour Party leader, Sir Keir Starmer. He's vying to become the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Yet on occasions, he seems to be prioritising Israel's interests over his own country's.
Westminster's known as the mother of all parliaments, but a recent attempt to vote on a ceasefire in Gaza seems to have been brought down by the underhanded skullduggery of Israeli assets within its halls. The SNP-drafted motion was scuppered by a last-minute intervention by Labour leader and pro-Israel enforcer Keir Starmer. Having consulted Israeli President Isaac Herzog, Starmer devised his last-minute plot to ruin the motion. The services rendered by Sir Keir Starmer to the genocidal Zionist entity are legion. All the way back when he was the Director of Public Prosecutions, he played a suspicious role in protecting Israeli war criminal Zippy Livni when she visited London. An arrest warrant had been issued for her in the UK due to her key role in the Zionist massacre in Gaza in 2008 and 2009. While the issues were still up in the air, Starmer met with Israeli State Attorney General Moshe Lador, and 2 months later, Starmer blocked the prosecution of Livni. The leadership campaign to push Starmer to the top of the Labour Party was bankrolled by Israeli lobbyist Trevor Chin. So Chin is the president of one of Israel's national institutions, the UJIA. He's also on the executive committee of Israel's largest lobby group in the UK, BICOM. Since becoming the leader of the party, Starmer has hired a former Israeli spy from the military intelligence unit, 8200 Asaf Kaplan, to perform the function of social listening for the party. Labour has also accepted a £5 million donation from Gary Lubner, who has also funded the United Jewish Israel Appeal, one of Israel's four national institutions. The Speaker of the House, Lindsay Hoyle, who collaborated with Starmer on this plan of sabotage, is also very close to the Israeli regime. He travelled to the Zionist entity with the Israeli ambassador to the UK, Zippy Hotevli, and waxed lyrical about the need to support Israel in its genocidal war on Gaza. He had also previously boasted about his father, MP Doug Hoyle, being one of the founding members of the Israeli embassy proxy, the Labour Friends of Israel. It seems democracy was aborted in the mother of all parliaments with an operation hatched in Tel Aviv.
David, just say a bit more, will you, about Lindsay Hoyle and his links to Israel.
So we saw in the film there his trip with the pro-settler extremist ambassador, Zippy Hotevli.
After October 7th,
after the launch of Al-Aqsa the Flood. So that there's an indication. He went with Labour Friends of Israel, obviously, and he has a long history with Labour Friends of Israel. And he, of course, has also, as he said, has boasted about his father's role in the creation of Labour Friends of Israel, which was actually, let's remember, back in the 1950s. It was created before Conservative Friends of Israel ever was, an indication of how long and how deep that goes back in Labour history. And, of course, Doug Hoyle was a Blair henchman, and that indicates to us, you know, the Zionist grip on the party is extremely tight, and you can barely move in the Labour Party in Parliament now for people who have some kind of connection to Labour Friends of Israel or to the Zionist movement. It's extraordinary.
Mm. Well, I asked James what he made of the fact that both the House of Commons Speaker and Deputy Speaker in the British Parliament are friends of Israel.
Well, look, it's my wholehearted view that the role of the Speaker and indeed the Deputy Speakers is to be non-partisan. I'm aware, obviously, that the Speaker and one of the deputies were Labour MPs. They, if you like, lose their party affiliation once they take the roles. But they shouldn't be engaged in any party political pressure groups, nor should they be friends of any organisation that shows loyalty to anyone other than the House of Commons. Their job is to uphold the constitutional precedents, conventions, rules in this country, and that is the only institution that they should be showing loyalty to.
David, why, in your opinion, do you think we should be concerned about Sir Keir Starmer hiring Asaf Kaplan, who, as we know, used to work for Israel's unit 8200, for, what did he call it, to undertake social listening for the Labour Party?
Well, I mean, this is one instance of very many of the infiltration of former unit 8200 operatives in British public life, in business, and also in politics. And so, of course, you know, the question is he still involved with unit 8200? Is he still loyal to them? Does he have any contacts with them still? What is the role of unit 8200 in the Labour Party? And more, what is the role of this social listening person in spying on Labour Party members? Where does the membership data go? Does it go back to Tel Aviv? And of course, those are the kind of questions that you would want to ask. But these are not the only concerns that there are. I mean, in the same office, it seems, until recently, it was a guy called Ben Sofa, who has a senior role in the Palestine Solidarity campaign, and that's a real, real concern as well. I mean, no one seems to be asking those kinds of questions.
No, indeed. Well, James has been a student of British politics for some years, so I asked him if he thought Britain's political elites had ever been as pro-Israel as they are today.
Well, this is the age of the political nobody, in part due to the constricting party system we have in place. If you go back 30 years, MPs were well-educated, articulate, knowledgeable, and were freer to speak their mind on a whole host of issues. These days, if you call for peace among both Israel and Palestine, as a Labour MP did, before Labour came round seemingly to that view, sort of, maybe, if not really, you get suspended from the party and therefore practically thrown out as an MP at the next election. There is a groupthink mentality that has become very prevalent in both main parties, and it really lowers the standard of political discourse in this country, and the public are worse served for it. There's no freedom of expression, freedom of debate, freedom of speech in the House of Commons anymore under the party whip system. If you speak out, you get thrown out. And that really isn't how it should be.
Well, David, I wonder what you make of Andrew Feinstein, the former ANC Member of Parliament under South African leader Nelson Mandela, going up against Sir Keir Starmer in his constituency. I mean, can he really win, do you think, there?
Well, what we're seeing here is really a replication of what happened after the invasion of Iraq. And I always quote the example of the Scottish Parliament in 2003, the elections there, where 7 Greens and 6 Socialists were elected. That was a quarter of the whole Parliament was elected on the anti-war vote in Scotland. Mm. Now, it was a proportional system, so easier there, and sure, so it'll be harder here. But there's a real possibility. George may win in Rochdale, Leanne may win in Ilford North, and Andrew Feinstein, I think, has got a fighting chance here. The question is how much more anger there's going to be and whether they can dissipate any of the anger. It looks like most of their attempts to dissipate the anger so far have only exacerbated the anger. So I think, you know, we have a good chance of having some serious victories here.
Mm, well, it'll certainly be interesting, for sure. Well, my final question to James was how he responded to those who claim that insurgent campaigns like George Galloway's in Rochdale and elsewhere in the country are simply empowering the Conservative Party.
Well, no party owns their voters. No party owns their electorate. Labour activists, Conservative activists, Liberal Democrat activists often throw at new candidates, insurgent campaigns, oh, you'll split the vote, you'll let Blair in. Look, our voting system in this country is pretty goddamn awful. I'm a full believer in proportional representation. But the notion that Labour owns the votes that we will undoubtedly win in Rochdale is for the birds. Every vote has to be earned at every election, one vote at a time, and that's exactly what we're doing in Rochdale. Well, look, they say it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, and I think anyone that has ever followed proceedings in the parliamentary chamber, whether they agree with George or not, knows that he's capable of doing far more than squeak. And let us not forget that George's views, especially on the Gaza issue, are held by a vast swathe of the British public. A large majority share the view that George has. And that is a voice that is not being represented in Parliament, with a few exceptions. The SNP group have been strong. But it is wholly weighted in favour of a view that very few people hold. And so I think a win in Rochdale ensures a springboard, if you like, for hundreds of independent candidates coming forward. Leanne Mohammed has already come forward, Shoka Adam in Leicester South. There'll be hundreds, I think, of independents, progressive independents, standing up against this duopoly that it currently serves nobody in Britain.
Well, finally, David, I mean, you know, if George does win, it looks like he's in with a good chance of winning in Rochdale. I mean, what difference do you think he will actually make? Look, he's only one person in the British Parliament. I mean, will it be significant? How will he shake things up, do you think?
Well, of course it will be significant. I mean, as everyone knows, George is one of the best political orators in the country. I've known George for some considerable years, of course, from Glasgow way back in the day, and he's been a big supporter of my work, and I've spoken on platforms with him on many occasions. Of course he'll shake things up, but it's not only about George, it's about what we build upon in relation to that. And, of course, the insurgent opposition has to be to push back against both major parties to fundamentally change their stance and to wean them away from the racist and genocidal Zionist movement.
Mm. And I think it will certainly give a boost, I guess, to other insurgent campaigns around the country if he does win. But I'm afraid, anyway, on that note, we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time. So let me thank our guest, James Giles, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
The Bahrain Grand Prix is 20 years old this weekend, but away from the celebrations on the track, activists tell a dark story of power and repression. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, Moussa Satrabi was 22 when the Grand Prix came to his home. At the time, he barely noticed the arrival in 2004 of the motorsport in the island kingdom of Bahrain, the smallest country in the Persian Gulf, was being trumpeted by politicians and the ruling royal family. But Satrafi, who holds a diploma in industrial rigging, had more pressing concerns. After 3 months, he had been made redundant from his job at the Bahrain Petroleum Company, BAPCO, as migrant workers, mainly from India and Nepal, were shipped in to replace locals. Satrafi and some other workers who had been laid off started protesting in front of the royal palace. They held signs that read, "We are Bahraini and we don't have a job," and "We are Bahraini and we are looking for a job." One day, the protesters saw a convoy of large vehicles heading in direction of Sakhir, the site of the $150 million circuit that was set to host the inaugural Grand Prix. Preparations were being made. The race was taking place that weekend. Satrafi told Middle East Eye, "The police came and they hit us. They said that they wanted to talk to us about our situation, that the authorities wanted to help us, and that we could discuss what was happening. The protesters went with the police out of sight of the palace and the main road leading to the track." Satrafi said, "It was just a way of moving us so that we wouldn't be seen by journalists and people going to the Grand Prix." At various points, Satrafi told MEE, key Bahraini leaders, including General Khalifa al-Fadlah, came to tell the protesters that they wanted to talk to them and that they would work things out. But the promise of a fair hearing never materialized. As well as protesting unemployment, Satrafi is part of Bahrain's Shia majority, which has suffered waves of repression in a country ruled for over two centuries by the Al Khalifa royal family.